I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Vincent Emanuele. He's a writer, radio host, and community organizer. He's currently opening a cultural center called PARC, Political Art Roots Culture, in Michigan City, Indiana, where he lives. So first off, thank you for all your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Ah, thanks for having me, and same to you.
And thanks for your friendship over the years, too.
Yeah, definitely. I have to say the same, and I say this as someone, I'd hate to bring in like the generational thing, but I will say that one of the things that I've been very fortunate to have is a lot of really good friends and mentors over the years. I consider you one of them, and I think that the thing for activists to think about is how they're going to do the same with other people, because I've met a lot of people over the years who haven't had that kind of guidance and help and just support, morally and professionally and all the rest. And so anyway, yeah, thank you.
Well, before we actually start the real interview, that's a great point. And I give a lot of interviews when people want to interview. A guy just a couple weeks ago is working on his first, dramatic screenplay, and it's going to be about environmental issues. So he wanted to come to Crescent City and talk about his screenplay. And I did it, and the reason I did it, one of the reasons I did it, is because when I was first starting as a writer, there were so many people who didn't know me at all who still gave me interviews. Robert J. Lifton, Susan Griffin, I mean, some fairly famous people, it's like, who didn't know me at all, and they said yes. And I am now, in a good sense, it is my responsibility. Responsibility comes from the root respondere, which means to give in return. It is my responsibility to do that same thing. Just like people from a previous generation held my hand and pulled me up the hill, now I need to reach back down and help younger people and pull them up the hill too.
I completely agree, and I appreciate it greatly.
So you said something, I saw something you wrote the other day about how your entire adult life has been colored by war. And can you tell people what you mean by that and what are some of the consequences of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was thinking about this conversation that we were going to have about this topic, I almost felt bad as I started reflecting on it. I kept thinking to myself, oh, how selfish to think that my life has been colored by war, you know. Well, I guess I can get back into that, but what I meant initially was that growing up in sort of like pop culture, Americana, like, you know, I was born in 1984. So I grew up with all of this, sort of hyper masculine, very toxic masculine representations of U.S. imperialism, U.S. exceptionalism, Sylvester Stallone movies, war movies, I mean, playing guns and cops and robbers and all the rest as a kid, just nonstop. And sort of just being in that environment. And I remember one of the first, I would say the first political memory that I have was in 1991, 92. And that was, there were twofold, the LA riots and the Gulf War in Iraq. And as I think about those two events today and thinking back on those being the first two events that I really remember, anything outside of like, you know, your mom, your dad, people you're hanging out with, your friends and family, those are the first two memories I have of the broader world that was out there. And I think that colored a lot for me as a 7-year-old. As an 8-year-old, you know, sitting there thinking, man, there's these things happening that I don't understand. Like, I knew at that time that there were things in society that I just didn't understand, and that there was violence and the capacity for violence, not only just for, say, individual violence, but violence of the state, on large scale was a very real thing. And then, you know, fast forward to 2001, and I'm sitting in, we moved out of Chicago. Now my family's living in Northwest Indiana. I'm going to school at a place called Chesterton High School, and I'm in a class, what was actually like a strength and conditioning class. I was a senior at the time, so you can start taking kind of fuck off classes or whatever, blow off classes. And we were sitting there and the TV was on and the first plane hit the building, hit the World Trade Center, and people were asking questions at that point, if your listeners will remember, and I think you, if you'll remember, at first people didn't know, you know, the plane hit, and people, commentators and the news and just the general public, I guess, because the people that I was around were doing the same thing. They're kind of asking, oh my God, is this an accident? What's going on? No one really knew. Then the second plane hit, and I didn't, you know, thinking back on that day on September 11th, I remember thinking, well, things are going to change, but I was so ignorant and I was so wrapped up in all this nonsense, I guess, that I was interested in as a high school kid, which had nothing to do with the outside world or with the living world. It had everything to do with, you know, sports and just very trivial things, which I guess are fine. But, you know, looking back now, I was just at the People's Climate Rally, like a offshoot here locally that was held on Saturday. And there was a 17-year-old girl from a neighboring high school who gave, in my opinion, the best speech of the day. And I'm sitting there thinking, God, I was such a bozo at 17. And here this girl is in front of hundreds of people giving a speech that, there's people who are 50 that couldn't give that speech. So it was just quite amazing to me, the contrast and thinking about, that. But anyway, I remember thinking, you know, after September 11th, you know, this isn't going to really affect me much, but I can see that again, once again in my life, that there are things going on in the world that I don't understand. And as a 17-year-old kid who didn't understand much, or didn't understand much about what was happening in the world, and as someone who had planned to play baseball, see, the whole, I don't know if we ever talked about this, I think we have, but the whole reason I ended up in the military to begin with was because I was terrible in school. So I graduated high school with like a 1.8, 1.9 GPA, which is about, in our grading system, is about as bad as you can get and still graduate. But I was very interested in sports and particularly baseball. And I was hoping to play baseball at like a Division III school or maybe a community college. My senior year, I think two or three games into the season, I fractured my wrist. And that was sort of the end of the game for me. I mean, I didn't have a senior year to build on. Couldn't really go to any camps because my wrist was still screwed up. And obviously, is the way that you swing a baseball bat, it really puts a lot of torque on your wrist. So that action itself was prohibited. And I had a friend who graduated midterm, came back from boot camp. The rest of us are graduating in May or beginning of June. He graduates in January, comes back into town right around the time that baseball season is taking place. And he says, hey, Vince, you know, I'm in the Marine Corps. And I'm thinking, man, you know, he's telling me about shooting guns and blowing things up and yada, yada, yada. And I'm thinking, all right, I'm in good shape. You know, I still was locked into this really toxic masculinity of seeing myself as this like man who, you know, this is what you're supposed to do. And this will make me look tough and this will make me look cool and all the rest. And, not thinking about the real world consequences of joining the U.S. Marine Corps and being a part of the empire or any of that. Went home, told my parents, my dad, who grew up in the Vietnam generation and who is a veteran. Told me I was an idiot. He was like, you're going to be sent to war. It's going to be another bullshit war. I see the writing on the wall. Of course, I didn't listen to him. I was 17 years old and knew a lot better than him. And, you know, I joined anyway. And so from 17 until, you know, we've talked about the war in the past. I don't want to get too much into it, but my experiences in Iraq were pretty horrific. I was in the infantry, so I had sort of an up close and personal relationship with all of the violence and torture and mutilation of dead bodies and all of this very sick, horrific stuff that we experienced and that we did and that we saw, and eventually joined the anti-war movement, and the rest has been history. But I guess that, because I could keep going on and on, but I think the thing is that the wars, I remember coming back from the war in Iraq and talking to Vietnam veterans and them saying, oh, you know, someday, brother, you know, you'll get to go back. You know, we got to go back to Vietnam. And, you know, by 1980, there were Vietnam veterans who were going back to Vietnam. You imagine that. You have helicopters leaving the embassy, literally leaving people, to die. The resistance taking over and 5 years later, you have veterans flying back to Vietnam to talk with people and to talk to Vietnamese guerrillas and resistance fighters, people who were just shooting at each other and trying to kill each other 5 years prior. I remember them saying that to me, and I remember thinking the situation in the Middle East is infinitely more complex than the war in Vietnam. Not that that war isn't complex, or you know, I'm not trying to say that, but what I am trying to say is that it is much more complex. And I never saw us having the ability to go back or anything like this. And I never saw an end to the wars. And the people who I really respect who, let's say English speaking writers from the Western world who I think people could identify with their writings and their references would be people like Patrick Coburn and people like Robert Fisk. And I hope they're not jerks in real life, but they're as is sometimes the case, but their writings are so important. And I remember Patrick Coburn years ago saying, look, I mean, this will probably be like the Germanic Wars where you're maybe 30 or 40 years. There's too many outside forces at play, so on and so forth. And I kept thinking, this is just never going to end. That after 9/11, that, you know, and Chomsky points this out correctly, and I think it's one of his best points that he made after 9/11, was that every state apparatus in the world was going to use 9/11 as an excuse to ramp up militarism, to crack down on civil liberties, to use it as a pretext for war, so-called terrorism or actual terrorism, and so on. And that is the case. And after the financial collapse of 2008, that even ramped things up even more. Now with what's happened in Syria, there is, I mean, unfortunately, no end in sight. So I guess when I wrote that, I'm probably not even articulating it as best as I can, because when I wrote it, I had such a rush of emotions, and I was thinking to myself, another war, you know, Korea, Syria. I mean, it's just, after I got back from Iraq, we continued in Afghanistan. We're continuing in Afghanistan today. More civilians were killed last year in Afghanistan than at any point over the last 16 years. It's the longest war in U.S. history with no end in sight. Some people argue that the government is as corrupt or more corrupt than it's ever been in Afghanistan. It's estimated that the Taliban run at least 60% of the country, which for some people, that's not a bad thing. So that's not to assume that just because the Taliban run, but they'll give you an idea of the sort of lack of control that the U.S. has and what the U.S. thinks it's going to do and what is actually happening. And I just keep thinking about the fact that I have not turned on a TV and or been intimately exposed to war and some kind of a warfare, whether it's Libya or Somalia or Yemen or Syria, basically since I was 17. And then from 17 until 22, doing two tours I don't even want to call it duty, doing two tours in Iraq. It seems like, and that's expanded too, actually. Let me add that, and this ties back in some weird way. I mean, in 2014, when Michael Brown was shot, I remember sitting here and thinking, well, we have to go. And we went down to Ferguson because it's only about a 5 hour drive from where I live. And I went with local activists. One of whom is one of the leaders here of the local Black Lives Matter group. His name is Jonathan Wilson. I think he would mind me mentioning his name. In fact, I hope people check out his work. But I remember going down there and I remember thinking, man, the war, you know, the war is everywhere. I mean, and your work, of course, has also informed me of this. And I think, you know, it's not just a war against people. It's not just a war against poor people or against people of color or against people overseas, Muslims and Arabs and so on, or Persians, that it's just a war. It's a war against everything that stands for love. It's a war against anything that's meaningful. It's a war against life itself. It's just this, I guess, death urge, as we've talked about in the past. And I thinking here of like Freud's work, where it's like this very, very dark view of what civilization or a very dark view of humanity and then what civilization does, which is just create this constant war. So, yeah, anyway, I don't even know if I'm answering your questions. Now I'm getting back into that space as I'm talking about it.
Well, I there's a couple directions we can go, and you can go either one of these or both or neither. And one of them is that, you know, in some ways, if we just talk about the U.S., so we can, of course, talk about this for civilization, too, and for patriarchy, but if we just talk about it for the U.S., in some ways, it's a fairly constant state since the United States has been in undeclared wars, you know, since its inception, really.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, against Indians, against the British, against Mexico, Philippines, Spain, we can just, you know, go on and on and on. And yep. That's one of the things that's required when you're going to have an empire, of course. And then sort of another direction, so you can either go that direction, and another direction is, I was watching a documentary that was actually quite good on the Oklahoma City bombing.
Mm. Is it the one that just came on Netflix?
Yes.
I started it, but I fell asleep 15 minutes in, but I want to finish it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's quite good. Originally put out by PBS, and in there they feature for a while Timothy McVeigh.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a line that really struck me, which is he was sort of all gung-ho about the military until he was a sniper, and he shot an Iraqi soldier in the head and saw it through his scope and suddenly realized, this man has never done anything to me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, there's a couple directions we can go with this. One of them is, if you change the nationalities, this is a story, this is an anecdote that we have heard said by World War I soldiers, World War II soldiers, by soldiers of all times.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a direction you can go with this. And the other direction, possibility, is that he came back. And this is going to be a longer question than I normally ask. He came back, and then he really got into the Turner Diaries, and he got into the whole white supremacist movement. And it really made me think of something that 20 years ago, I interviewed Joel Dyer, who wrote a book called Harvest of Rage about the militia movement emerging from rural communities in the American Midwest as impartially in response to the farm crisis. And one of the things he said was that if you are sitting in your kitchen with an empty bottle of Jack Daniels and your family has left, you're losing your farm, and you got a shotgun in your lap, you're wondering whether to put that in your mouth, and there's a knock on your door, and that person at the door is a white supremacist who's coming to sit there and put his arm around your shoulder and say, it's going to be okay, buddy. And if that person comes to the farm auctions and says, it's going to be okay, you will become a white supremacist. If that person's a Jehovah's Witness, you'll be a Jehovah's Witness. If that mm-hmm. person is a Mormon, that you'll become a Mormon. And if that person were a lefty, you might become a lefty.
Right.
That when Joel Dyer was going around the country, he at the time was riding a motorcycle with hair down to his butt. And he was terrified going into some of these rural communities, but he would walk into the cafe and say, I want to talk to you about the farm crisis. Boom. They didn't care about the earring in his ear. They didn't care about how long his hair was. What they cared about is, here is somebody who actually cares. And so that's a different direction we can take this also, is sort of the failure of the American left to finish. That's it. I'm done rambling. So take that whichever direction you want.
Yeah, well, gosh, I'm thinking of all three. I mean, of course, the empire is, I mean, for me, that's been the end game from the beginning, is that we have to dismantle the empire. I mean, that is I guess if you have a pet project or the thing that you wake up and think about, I mean, everybody has that thing. That is definitely the thing for me is the empire, and then understanding my place within it. And then even, you know, this sort of dovetails with your work quite well, but the more I've read about historic empires as well, you know, so moving beyond, okay, so wait a minute, is this a bad war? Okay, it's a bad war. Oh, wait a minute, is it bad foreign policy since Vietnam? Or is it bad foreign policy since World War II? Or, oh no, wait a minute, this is built on a colonial genocidal project. Okay, so that's what it is. It's capitalism, it's industrialization, it's colonialism. Oh, but wait a minute, there's empires before that collapsed and exploited people. And so it's always forced me, thinking of empires always forced me. Maybe it's because I came to activism through thinking of empire, but it's always forced me to take into account a lot of other things. So the empire of cities, or the empire of industry, or the empire of patriarchy. Those kinds of things.
Just a second. This is one of the things I love about your work. And sorry to interrupt, but there's a line that an environmentalist friend of mine, John Osborne, always says, that a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundation of Western civilization, because they ask, why is this land being destroyed? Oh, to serve the economy? Why is any land destroyed? Usually to serve the economy. Why do you have an economy that is based on destroying land? And you keep asking questions back. And it's the same with you, that you start with the question. This is what I love about your work, is you don't stop. You don't say, oh, okay, so empire is bad, and stop there. It's like, okay, let's take this back. Let's go back again. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think what that takes is, at least for me, and we talked about this earlier as we were talking, which I probably shouldn't say that. That's bad radio, huh, when you reference something that the audience can't listen to yet. But nonetheless, when we're talking about Brazilian jiu-jitsu and humility, I mean, I think part of this for me has always been this very humbling experience of being this working class kid who barely graduated high school, who doesn't have a college degree, and who, you know, just kind of found myself in Ivy League schools and crazy protests and events with like all these people who are speaking all these different terms and talking about all these different things that I, as a 22-year-old veteran with very little academic knowledge or really, you know, worldly experience outside of being in a war, which isn't a worldly experience, I guess. I just always have thought to myself, well, you don't really know shit. So you know some things, you know what's bad and what's good on some fundamental level, but it's like, you know, I just never had this idea that like, oh, okay, I've got it figured out. And then, you know, I've started from, and this is going to sort of sound hippy dippy and definitely not of my generation, but I started out getting involved like through psychedelics and being in the Marine Corps and coming back from my second tour and friends giving me mushrooms and us sitting around and having these long conversations and sessions of just crying and getting out all of that nasty shit that we've kept inside of ourselves and hid from our lovers and our families and our friends. And, you know, those experiences and, you know, as corny as this sounds, you know, listening to like old lectures from people like, Terrence McKenna and these goofballs like Timothy Leary. But, you know, I took away from that, like this thing for me, it was always like, you have to think for yourself and you always have to keep asking questions and you always have to question authority. And so when I got to the political movement or to the anti-war movement, it was like, you know, I would like run into these folks and I'd be like, hey, I'm with the ISO or I'm with this group or that group. And that's not to point out the ISO, my friends who are with the ISO, but you know, whether it's the RCP, it could be anything, but I would always look at those folks and I'd be like, wait a minute. So you're coming up to me with a book that's several hundred years old that was written by some old guy. And you're telling me that I just have to understand this and then I'll get it. And I'm like, this just sounds too familiar. I'm like, wait a minute. Where did I hear this before? Oh, that's right. I was raised as a Catholic. So I've heard all of that crazy fucking nonsense. And so I'm not going to buy it again. And then I saw it again in the military where it was like just people blindly following orders and all of these crazy symbols and ideologies. And I'm thinking to myself, this isn't to me what the left is supposed to be all about. I mean, to me, being an activist, being a thinker, a writer, an artist, I mean, to me, it's always kind of, how do we remain as critical as possible without turning into a bunch of curmudgeons? So, I mean, I love Nirvana, right? I mean, I love Kurt Cobain. I grew up on that music. But I don't want our people ending up putting a shotgun in their mouth and blowing their brains out. I mean, I've had, on a different level, more friends die coming home from the war who've killed themselves than who died when we were in Iraq, just from that guilt, from that alienation, you know, not because they think the war was justified, obviously. So even if they didn't speak out publicly about it, which I would argue if they did, they probably wouldn't be killing themselves. But that's hard to make that argument too, because I know a lot of veterans who came back and did speak out and did very constructive things, wrote albums, toured the country talking about their experiences in war, worked with refugees, and they still killed themselves. So I think, you know, it's hard to jive like this constantly remaining critical of what's happening, constantly trying to push yourself and challenge yourself morally, intellectually, you know, even for me, socially, you know. So on the one hand, I feel like as a writer, I wrote this the other day and I don't know if this is right or not. It's probably one of those things that I regret writing down the road, which I think often happens with people who write. But, you know, I was like, oh, well, your job as a writer is to tell the truth and your job as an activist sometimes it was like different. I forget how I put it, but the point was that you know, it's really tough. You want to be as critical as possible, but then my job on another level as someone who's doing more and more community organizing work, and I do think there's a distinction there between community organizers, activists, maybe even I would add protesters to the mix, protesters being folks who just kind of show up to the rallies and marches and that's about it, activists who do a little more work, and then the organizers who are like that 1% that you were mentioning out of the 90, and then the 9%, the people who are just constantly doing work. And I found myself in this position now, and it's I kind of forgot where I was going with that. I'm not going to lie to you, but what I will say here, to sort of cap that off, is that it seems to me that the only way to constantly question and to move from, say, just that environmental project that you're opposed to something else, the question for me has always been how much of that is subjective, individual, and how much of that can be intentionally sort of imposed on people. So we have let's talk about this in the real world. We have the largest sand dune in the county, just down the road from my house, and they want to build, it's called Bismarck Hill. I had sent you an email about invasive species, which they were pulling out of the dune, to make way for what we now learned is going to be cabins for tourists and a zip line. And I think, you know, so that's a good that's a good campaign for local environmentalists and people to try and stop. There's no construction that's been done. There's no engineers or any surveying company that's really been up there. They're just in the beginning part of the bidding process. So there's no developer that's already put a bid down. So this is a good time. And I think this is going to be a good environmental campaign for people to work on in the city. And I think people are going to learn a lot through that. But the question Sergio and I have been asking each other over and over again is how do we intentionally get people? So you're going to get the people who are come out. They see that it's this one project, and then on their own, they're going to take it further. For us, the question is, you know, how can we intentionally get more and more people to take it further and further? So how can we use this campaign in the best way possible? And here I'm thinking of somebody like Thomas Lindsay's work, you know, where even if you don't win, there's a lot that you can learn from a single issue campaign like this. So, you know, doing those things in an intentional fashion and trying to draw that out for people who won't do it on their own, that remains, I think, a major challenge and a question that I constantly have.
So, and thank you for that. And let's go back to Timothy McVeigh for a moment and go.
Oh, and I was going to say about that. I'm sorry. Can I interrupt you this time?
Please.
And you know, I was going to say about that on a much more somber note, the sick thing about McVeigh's reflections is that I can wholly identify with that. Meaning the moment that I first killed someone in Iraq was by far the most seminal moment of any of all of the development that's happened over the years. That was the moment when I looked at this sort of cold, dead eyes of this person and just thought to myself, wow, man, you're halfway around the world. You're a young kid. You don't know what the fuck you're doing over here. You should not be over here. You know you shouldn't be over here. This person that's lying in front of you now, most likely, especially in that part of the world, has children, even at a young age, who's probably 17, 18 years old, probably has a couple of children, probably has a wife, has a whole family that's waiting for him, and likely a whole tribe or a village that's waiting for him, and he will never come home. And, you know, I talked to my therapist at the VA about this. It's not, for me at least, it's not, and it's nasty, arms being blown up, limbs laying all over the place, the guts and all the rest. It is nasty. I'm not someone who likes that kind of stuff. I actually, like, if I see someone getting injured, I don't like it to this day, even after seeing all of that stuff. But for me, that's not what causes the nightmares or the PTSD. For me, it was, why did we do those things? You know, it was because of, you know, corporations and empire and all the rest. So in other words, if someone came to your house and they threatened you and your mother, I think if you killed that person, say you shot them right in the face and their face exploded in front of you, I think there's going to be a part of that that remains with you, and it's not going to be pretty, and it's going to be something that comes up probably in weird ways, as I can attest to from firsthand experience. But what I will say is that I don't think you'll be sitting there years later going, man, why did I do that? I can't believe I did that. Was it the right decision? Well, hell yes, it was the right decision. You were protecting yourself and the people that you love or the things that you love. In my situation, and I'm probably the same for McVeigh, the question was, well, wait a minute. we were just told or we were just asked to kill someone and our friends are being killed. And we don't actually, well, some people are like, hey, we don't really know why. And other people go, no, we know why, because of geopolitical interests and corporate profits and all the rest. And that, to be honest with you, is what causes the most trauma.
Yeah. I remember during World War One, there was, I'm gonna butcher this, but basically at one point they're in the opposite trenches and one side puts up a sign that basically says, you know, the Germans put up a sign that say, the English stink, and it gets shot up. And then the English put up a sign that says, the Germans stink, and that gets all shot up. And then one side or the other says, basically, the political leaders stink, let's all go home. And everybody cheers. Hmm. You know, never mind the fact that if they would have actually stopped, they would have gotten shot by their own armies. Right. So let's move on to... So once again, two directions. You can either talk about the thing I said about Joel Dyer and about McVeigh when he came back becoming a... I mean, where is the left in terms of reaching out to a lot of potential recruits who... I mean, his analysis... Let's take off what he did later, because he was then, you know, part of this white supremacist stuff. Let's leave off that. And his analysis of war was actually, that was in that documentary, was actually quite cogent and quite good. And I feel like he could have been, I was talking to a friend about that who said, you know, had he been reached by the right people, he could have become another Vince, you know, talking about you.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could either talk about, you know, the left or, in terms of organizing, or if you'd rather, we can talk about the thing we mentioned during the introduction about the center called Political Arts Root Culture, the Park Center. And I don't know if you want to meld those two or...
Yeah. Or yeah, let's definitely bring them together. Because what you're mentioning is what, I mean, Sergio and I finding this space, so a little background for folks. This gentleman that I'll be referencing in the next 10 or 15 minutes, his name is Sergio Corrigan. We met each other. We were in the same platoon in the Marine Corps. We weren't necessarily that close during that period, which is interesting. It wasn't only until about the last year that we were in. We were back from our second deployments, and we just started spending a lot of time together and smoking a lot of dope and just kind of talking about what the hell was going on and who we were and the changes we were going through and our worldviews and all the rest. And then we both got back to the States, joined the anti-war movement. We went in our separate ways, have kind of found each other again. Then we go away for a couple of years, go do different projects. And he's recently been shooting a documentary in Ukraine about the situation there, where he's a native, born Ukrainian. So he left, his family left Ukraine when the wall fell. I mean, so you talking about another individual who has a unique perspective on collapse and civilizations and so on. I think just his personal experience backed up with his politics is just truly makes him a fascinating person. And so I have great respect for Sergio as much or if not more than anyone else in this world. And so he came back just before Standing Rock. He was traveling back and forth from Philadelphia where his mother and father lived to, Ukraine to film. He came back in late November. We saw the call out for veterans to go to Standing Rock. We went to Standing Rock. That might be a whole nother interview in and of itself, just to talk about that from a, I talked with Max Wilbert a little bit about this, but just from a tactical strategic standpoint and what this means and what people should learn from that, I think is something to think about. But anyway, we ended up going to Standing Rock, spent a lot of time talking in the car, spent a lot of time at our camp talking with other folks. And when we were back home at my place, when we returned to Michigan City about a week after we left for Dakotas, we basically came to the conclusion that, hey, we need to put down roots somewhere. So that's kind of where it ties into the acronym. And I'm giving ourselves too much credit because that just kind of came up one night just thinking about the name. We were then like, all right, how do we make this fit? But it does work because the question for us was, you know, how do we put down roots? I've seen a lot of activists who kind of bounce around the country or bounce around the world. So they work for an NGO for a few years. Then they move to Portland and they work for another NGO for 5 years. Then they move to New York City and they work for one for 3 years. And, you know, I've seen a lot of that over the last 11 years of being active, and I can see the limitations to that. And I can, and I think, you know, even for me, I mean, so thinking of being humble and constantly trying to learn, when the Bernie Sanders campaign kicked off, you know, a lot of people, of course, people who are going to listen to this are going to say, oh God, but that's so, you know, it's just not that radical and this or that. I mean, from the perspective of an organizer, I thought to myself, you know, speaking of the left being tone deaf, I'm thinking, okay, first of all, let's not bullshit all of us. I mean, I don't think if anyone asked us a couple years ago, hey, if this democratic socialist runs for president, do you think he's going to have a chance against Hillary Clinton? I've been like, no, you're crazy. She's going to crush him and she's going to be president. And that's just the way it is. So I think we, maybe I speak for myself, but I had a lot to learn, you know, thinking of like just these assumptions that I make and, oh, well, no, I don't think that this town that I live in Michigan, well, the city in Michigan City of 35,000 people in the neighboring city of LaPorte, which I think is very close, about 30,000 people. You know, I'm like, there were house parties with 50, 60 people who are like, no, I'm a socialist. And not that I don't identify as a socialist and not that that necessarily means that much to me, but in our context, in reality, and where we are here in Northwest Indiana, to see that, I thought to myself, man, this is amazing. But what was lacking during this process? All of these new people coming in, all of this new energy, but there was no spaces that we had here in Michigan City. And there was no institution or leftist organization that could orientate people. You know, they were just going to house parties. People were holding these things at pubs and restaurants and VFW halls and all the rest. And the whole time I'm thinking to myself, well, this is a missed opportunity of a magnitude that might not come around again. Now, a lot of those people I kept in contact with, they're people who I'm organizing with today. And that was the reason why I was encouraging our leftist friends to get involved with that campaign to begin with. I mean, it had nothing to do with Bernie Sanders or even his policies. It was, you know, let's find some more people that we could bring into the mix and people who, from my experience, were sort of first-time activists. And so they were open to a lot of new ideas. You know, when we approached them and would say things like, hey, let's do a class or let's talk about the limitations of like Bernie Sanders' environmental policies or his view on foreign policy and stuff like this, that, you know, people were very receptive to that. And I think more so than a lot of leftists assume people would be. So anyway, fast forward to right after Standing Rock, and Sergio and I are saying, okay, let's put down roots. Let's say, hey, let's give it 5 years. You know, hopefully the landlord cooperates. We'll see. Yeah, we'll see. He seems like a very nice person and he allowed us to sign the 2-year lease. So it's right on the main drag in town in a place called Midtown, which is a little more seedy than say the downtown area that's getting all of this attention, of course, like every other city, arts districts and all the rest. So there's a profound disconnect here in our city to give people a little background when I mentioned Michigan City. Sits right on Lake Michigan. It's about 50 miles to the east of Chicago. The city's about 1/3 black, 10% Hispanic, and the rest, mainly, white folks. 30% of the city lives officially under the federal poverty line. We know the federal poverty line is absurdly low. For a family of four, it's $24,700, and I don't even know, it's something even more crazy for an individual. So really, in our city, we're talking about 60% of the city lives in poverty. We have an Indiana state prison, maximum security prison here. It's the only prison in the state that executes people. We also have the largest building in Northwest Indiana, which is the Boyd Blue Chip Casino and Gaming Hotel. That is the largest building in our region. We also have a half coal and half natural gas fired power plant that sits right on the lake. And that's also in between all of the mills that still operate and the steel mills and manufacturing plants by the hundreds that have closed as you drive from here to Chicago. So we do live in sort of the heart of the Rust Belt. It's a very segregated area. It's a somewhat violent area. Although I will say, you know, in Michigan City, even though, I mean, there's people who have been shot pretty regularly here over the last year, but nothing like Chicago, and it's crazy even to say that actually now I'm thinking about it, because when I talk to my friends overseas, they're like, what do you mean two people were shot in the last 3 weeks? Like, to them, that's insane. But then when I talk to my friends in Chicago, well, and I should clarify, when I'm talking about friends overseas, I'm talking about friends in Europe or friends in, in Australia, whereas, of course, friends who are living in Afghanistan or Iraq or Venezuela or Syria, I mean, this is a nonstop thing. So anyway, I don't want to get too off track. We have this space. We're dealing with all the problems that the Rust Belt deals with. One of the things that's lacking in the Rust Belt, in my thinking, is a serious environmental movement. I think there's many reasons for that. The environmentalists who are involved, I think, are extremely dedicated in taking a lot of risks because you have industry, the remaining industry that's here is seen as like untouchable. It's like we had all these hundreds of thousands of jobs and then they left, but now at least we still have these 30,000 union jobs, and God forbid if they go, then this whole place is going to go down. Getting to your work, or getting to the things that I've learned through your work, of course, that would probably be a good thing. In fact, it would definitely be a good thing for the living world. The contradiction that we're dealing with is, what would that look like in the short term for the people here? Maybe in the long term, people would be able to survive some kind of an immediate stop to those jobs, or if we took away those industries somehow. What I worry about is that some of this sort of existing tensions and racial segregation and violence would creep up in really, really bad ways. But nonetheless, that's what we're dealing with here. That's the context. Sergio and I decided that we wanted to open a space because there are no non-consumerist spaces in Northwest Indiana. So for us, the brief definition of that is basically you don't have to come and buy a damn thing if you walk through the door. We're going to have a little miniature library. We're going to have free Wi-Fi access. We're going to have plenty of information to plug people in, how to get involved. And even more importantly, and this is really what we want to do, is to make this truly a collaborative experience. Like, we want people to come in here. So if you lived in our town and you came here and you said, hey, Vince and Sergio, my name's Derek. I want to do this on Thursday nights from 8 p.m. till 10 p.m. I want to do documentary film night twice or once a week or once every 2 weeks. Cool. You know, we've had people come in and say, hey, do you mind if we do a creative writing workshop on Sundays, you know, first Sunday of the month? Yes, no problem. You know, so anything like that, everything from art installations to teach-ins to a place for public speakers to come to a place for people in the local community to just hang out and get to know each other, where, you know, we just don't have those spaces. I think of someone like Morris Berman's work, and I know you're a fan of his work as well, but, you know, he talks about the amount of times that Americans used to get together with friends and family. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, it was like upwards of 12, 15 times a year. Now it's like down to 2 or 3 times a year. You know, and it's like that on a community level as well. There's nowhere really for people to hang out except for bars and restaurants. And the restaurants are becoming more and more bourgeois. So it's like, you know, they're catering to the Chicago folks who come here as tourists. So that's out of the reach for the majority of people here who, as I mentioned, 60% of the native population, well, native by people who just live here, you know, living in poverty. That's, you know, those are the kinds of things, I guess, that we're going to be dealing with here. And that's kind of the vision that we have for the space, is to use it as a hub, not just here locally, but even regionally. And as far as we can tell, in the Great Lakes region, there's really not much like this happening. So, you know, that's what we'd like to do.
I'm thinking of a line by Michael Moore where he said that much of the militia movement, at least in Michigan, would be the unemployed arm of the United Auto Workers. And so it's not a surprise that, you know, as American jobs have been exported, as the economy is globalized, and as the American empire has begun its collapse, the white supremacist movement has gained a lot of power, and a lot of harmful revolutionary movements, I think, sort of hard right revolutionary movements, have gained power. And it seems to me that, I mean, this takes us back to the Timothy McVeigh or the Joel Dyer. It seems to me that one of the things that instead, with proper organization of the left, that whole area should really be a hotbed for, at the very least, socialism.
Yeah.
If we can get people to understand the real source of their misery, the real source of white people's misery there is not black people, but instead the capitalist system. And that's a struggle we've been facing for you know, generations. There's a great book, you know, How the Irish Became White, of how the Irish, you know, became really racist coming over here. And, and so it seems to me that what you're doing is a step in that direction. And let me know if this is wrong. A step in that direction of attempting to, create those spaces where people can start to, question the real sources of their misery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a much better way than I could even put it. I mean, I think the challenge is, you know, this should be a hotbed for socialism. I completely agree. I mean, the thing that I've noticed, and you think of militia movements or even think of Trump's rhetoric, I mean, a lot of this, and I've talked with other folks about this as well, but there's this, and some of this is important, the language people use and how they speak to one another, how they view one another. Those things are very important. I know you find that to be extremely important as well, just language in general and how, and the words people use or the words we choose to not use. But sometimes I feel like the left will spend too much time on etiquette and not enough time on just kind of understanding, all right, this out of work person is pissed off. They're angry. They don't really understand who they should be pissed off at, but they kind of do. They're pissed at their bosses. They're pissed at their manager. They know they're being fucked around. Maybe they have some prejudice ideas, or maybe they're racist. Maybe they have some very sexist views. Maybe they've displayed that. Now, the question for me is always, how much can we work with those folks? And so the challenge for organizers is you find someone like that, you try and turn them on to the right things. You try and educate them. You obviously yourself try and learn from them as well, whatever you can learn. And then I think after some time, whatever that time, I guess, has to be determined by the organizer or by those organizations. You know, at some point, if the person isn't willing to change, then it's okay. Now we have to move on to the next and so forth. But I'm probably getting off on my own tangent about just more sort of the nitty gritty of trying to organize these people as just, you know, the people that you're talking about and the folks that I'm mentioning who are Trump supporters. I mean, this was also a wheelhouse for Trump supporters. So, or for Trump himself for the election, this whole Rust Belt area. And I understood it for the first time, you know, I was not using my anecdotal experiences to highly, inform the way that I was looking at the election. I was thinking, oh man, you know, Nate Silver and them are right, you know, she's gonna crush him and that's it. And I should have been paying more attention to my real life experiences because I kept going everywhere and running into people who weren't rabid racists or who weren't people who you and I would immediately sort of run into and go, oh my God, I don't want to spend any more time around this person. But people who are genuinely concerned about all kinds of things, people who are genuinely angry and many times for the right reasons, just that the wrong people or the wrong entities. And Trump did kind of both of what you mentioned. I mean, not only did he, you know, play to the racism and the xenophobia, but he also played up this populist message. So what does this all mean for us as organizers or thinking of a situation like Timothy McVeigh? And this space, this park space here in Michigan City. I mean, to tie all of that together, we need these spaces. And for Sergio and I, we feel like we can use our combined experience to try and avoid a lot of the mistakes that we've seen other movements and other organizations make, whether that's through hypersectarianism, whether that's through egos, whether that's through financial difficulties, like all of these things that we've learned, whether working with community groups or different social movements or different 501c3s. How can we take that knowledge combined, I guess, 20 something years now, which sounds crazy and not that much compared to others. But I think to myself, all right, we're both 32 years old. Let's try and do this for 5 years. Let's see what we can do by the time we're 37 years old, 38 years old, maybe say 40. You know, it takes 5 or 7 years to, in my opinion, to put together a good project like this. So when that, as this takes place and as it changes and as more and more people get involved, our idea is, to be honest with you, Derek, let's hand it off as soon as possible. I mean, so we want to find another member of that small group within groups that wants to really take this and make it into something or own it. The ideal situation is we're 38 years old. We've had the place for 5 years. It's an institution in our community. It's an institution in the Northwest Indiana region. And now it's time for a 24, 25, 28 year old, another 30 year old to take over and grab this, or a group of people to take over, grab it, make it into something new and interesting. I mean, I don't often make these generational like debates or distinctions, but I do think that it's very important for a space like this where you're going to have live music and cultural activities to constantly have that fresh blood and those young people who are involved with them, young ideas. And that's not to say that older ideas or older cultural practices shouldn't be respected, but it is to say that I think, especially in an urban environment like this, and especially in a city that's as diverse as the city in which I live, I do think it's like vital for us to make this space as inclusive as possible, particularly for us around race, gender, and ethnicity. But also, you know, to make sure that we don't ever feel like, oh, this is our project, and if we can't let it go, or we want to have all the control of it. I mean, I really think it's important for us to keep in mind that if we do this the right way, 5, 7, 8 years from now, we'll be handing this off to another group of people who can take it and hopefully make it into something much better than whatever we had in mind.
So we are really close to being out of time. So you literally have like a minute left, and I would like for you to say two things in 1 minute. One of them is, so for people in the region who want to actually come to this place, how do they do that? And two, for someone who wants to replicate this and start something similar in Cincinnati or Cleveland or Erie or Tallahassee, what should they do?
If you want to come, the address, it's PARC, we call it PARC, Politics, Art, Roots, and Culture. It's at 1713 Franklin Street in Michigan City, Indiana. If you live in South Bend or if you can get to Chicago, there's a train that will take you 8 blocks from our place. So you can jump on the South Shore train, get off on the 11th Street stop in Michigan City, Indiana, and you will be just down the road from PARC. You can also check out our Facebook page, PARC, Politics, Art, Roots, and Culture. We're setting up our email and all of the rest, so I'm sorry I don't have that quite ready for you. What was your second question, Derek? I'm sorry.
Second question, if somebody wants to do this in Tallahassee, Cincinnati, Salt Lake City.
Find yourself someone that you love and trust and that you can be brutally honest with, because the only reason this works and the only reason it worked, it's gonna work, if it does work, is because Sergio and I have that kind of a relationship. I don't think you have to go to war for that kind of relationship. In fact, I would suggest people don't go to war for that kind of relationship. But, you know, find that person or that group of small group of people that you honestly can trust and that you know are in a good place to be able to start something like this. And then, you know, I would also argue, make sure you get input from the people who have already been active. The only reason this works is because we've been more and more active in the local community, and I'm getting more and more connected with people here. It will not work, I don't think, if you just kind of hop in and say, hey, my name's Vince, and I just moved here, and now I live in Detroit, and I want to open up a thing like this. I think that could work if you're an out-of-towner, if you properly connect with the people who are already doing organizing work. So that would be my number one recommendation. And then, you know, number two, again, as I mentioned before, would be make sure you find people you can trust and people you can work with, because, you know, once you have a space like this, you know, you're going to be with each other nonstop, and you have to trust each other. And that's probably a broader lesson for organizing in general, is to constantly try and find those people. But anyway, that's not a really eloquent way to end, but I appreciate the time, man.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on the program. I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Vince Emanuele. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.